WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you this Sunday, July 12th, 2009. It's my great pleasure to be here. We have a wonderful show for you today. Our guest is someone who's an expert on many subjects, not the least of which is economics. He's one of the great economic journalists of our times, and also an expert on Latin American politics. So we have a twofer today. Our guest will be Mark Weisbrot from who's been a frequent guest on the program in the past. It should be a terrific show. Mark is, of course, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of books and articles, and someone who has great wisdom to share with us on the great problems of our time. So join us today on Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Julius Genachowski held his first meeting as chairman of the Federal Communications Commission last week. He wasted no time in moving the process of creating a national broadband plan to the top of his agenda. Congress has mandated that the FCC develop a set of recommendations by February 2010 for bringing high-speed internet access to every American. Genachowski said that the agency must ensure that broadband is affordable and that people understand how to use it to its fullest capacity.
Broadband is not a solution to any single problem. It is part of the solution to almost every major problem our country faces. I cannot imagine a more important set of tasks for this agency at this moment in history.
Genachowski described the importance of broadband for creating jobs, economic growth, and much more.
A small business in Boston, the Bronx, or Blacksburg, Virginia, connecting and selling its products to consumers across the country and the globe. Parents in Brownsville, Texas, video conferencing with their son or daughter, serving in Baghdad or Kabul. A diabetic in rural West Virginia whose insulin level is continuously monitored in a hospital 100 miles away. A student in a remote Alaskan fishing village. An Iowa farming town. An Indian reservation in New Mexico learning math and science over broadband from a teacher at Loyola or Duke or Columbia.
But Genachowski warned that just because we can imagine such a bright future doesn't mean we'll automatically have one.
The sad reality is that we are slipping behind as a nation when it comes to broadband. Homes and businesses in many other countries have faster connections for lower prices. It will take real effort and dedication and a long-term commitment to renew American leadership and competitiveness for the 21st century.
The commission also heard from Blair Levin, a former FCC chief of staff who is now coordinating the agency's broadband effort. Levin outlined plans for a series of open meetings to be held in Washington and across the country in late summer and early fall.
We're going to take part of that process and put it in this room, open to the public, on the web, open to a variety of questions from a variety of different sources.
For more information about the FCC's National Broadband Plan, go to broadband.gov.
Last week, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration and the Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service released the rules on how the $7.2 billion in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for expanding broadband infrastructure will be spent. Buried within the 121-page document were some important precedents for proponents of an open internet. Timothy Carr, campaign director of Free Press, explains.
What's important about these rules and what's important about the stimulus legislation, which was passed earlier this year, is that they make net neutrality a part of the DNA of all public funding. It's an important precedent, and it's an important milestone for this new administration and the new Congress that states that in order for any entity to receive taxpayer money to build out broadband, they must respect net neutrality as the basic rule of the road. And these rules, again, just reiterated that.
Net neutrality is the basic principle that all web content, regardless of its source or destination, will be treated equally by internet service providers.
So we've reached a point where we see net neutrality being supported both by the new president, supported by new leadership in Congress, and now parts of the federal bureaucracy are respecting net neutrality as a basic fundamental tenet of all internet connectivity going forward.
While this precedent is important, it is only one piece of the puzzle that will ensure net neutrality becomes the law of the land.
This is just a small part of an overall effort amongst net neutrality supporters, just a small piece of the bigger picture. We need also for the FCC to act more aggressively in cracking down against ISPs, network providers that violate the basic principles of net neutrality. We're hopeful, given the new chairman there, Julius Genachowski, that that's what they'll do in the future. But we also need Congress to pass net neutrality legislation, and we anticipate legislation to be introduced sometime this summer. So we're pushing on several fronts at the FCC, in Congress, and really through the federal bureaucracy in terms of funding for broadband to make sure that net neutrality is the basic rule of the road.
To learn more about net neutrality, visit SaveTheInternet.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Coming to you live, July 12, 2009. Our guest today is one of the most popular guests we've had over the years on Media Matters during our 7 years on the air. He is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Mark Weisbrot is the co-author with Dean Baker, his running partner of The Phony Crisis on Social Security. Back in 2000 that came out, and is a newspaper columnist and reporter on economics and politics, an expert not only on the economy, but also on Latin American politics. So he is really in a position to talk about some of the breaking stories of the summer. Mark Weisbrot, welcome to Media Matters. Okay, not quite getting Mark yet. Let's see if we can hook Mark in. Again, our guest today is Mark Weisbrot, and we hope to be getting him in. I think we just have some engineering difficulties if we have him on the line. So if you bear with us, we will get to Mark Weisbrot momentarily. In the meantime, though, let me tell you who we have on tap for some of our programs over the next few weeks. We have, among other guests in line, will be Tom Frank, who's been a much-requested guest over the years. And Tom writes for the Wall Street Journal, as I'm sure many of you know. And I wonder, do we have you there, Mark?
Yes.
Great, Mark. We had a little mix-up there. I'm delighted to have you on with us. I've already given you your introduction.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And there's so much I want to talk to you about. So there's so much you can weigh in on that's breaking in the news. Initially, I thought I'd start with Latin America, but I think I'd like to go to that second and talk about Honduras and what's going on down there. First, really, I do want to turn to the economy, because it seems in the last week or two, and correct me if I'm mistaken, but it seems that in the news media, at least, there's an increasing recognition that the recovery is not going especially well, and that, there's no reason to expect this economy to get significantly better for quite some time. And this is going to create great political problems for politicians as a result. And I was wondering what your sense of the economy is right now, looking at it as in Washington, and what the range of debate is and what it should be for what to do.
Well, it is. You're right. The media is starting to recognize it. I mean, it was the bad data, the unemployment data for June, I think, that really woke a lot of people up. The economy lost 465,000 jobs, and there was a big drop in hours worked, too, which, it fell by 0.8%, which is a lot. It means that, this would be the equivalent of another 900,000 jobs, really, as compared to if the hours per worker didn't change. So these are this is a sign of a very, very weak labor market. And, overall, the easiest way to see it, we've been saying this for quite a long time at CBER, and my colleague Dean Baker has done a number of papers on this, but the easiest way to see it is you just look at the amount of stimulus that the stimulus package that has passed for 2009 to 2010, and you compare that to the expected fall off in private demand that you've had just from the bursting of the housing bubble, the stimulus is a very small fraction, maybe not even a tenth of how much we've lost and are continuing to lose in spending just from people having, you know, lost so much wealth in their homes, ability to borrow, of course, as well, and the decline in the construction sector, the fall off in construction spending, and all the other housing-related spending. If you just look at it that way, it's very clear that we need a third stimulus. And it is starting, I mean, people are starting to say it. In fact, the head of the IMF just last week said that he was saying for the rich countries in general, they may have to be looking towards another stimulus package. He was the, you know, one of the most recent economists to say that. And so I think that the, you know, Obama administration is going to eventually reach the same conclusion, but the question is when and how late, because it does make a big difference when.
Now, Mark Weisbrot, when we talk about the term stimulus package, what we're referring to, correct me if I'm wrong, because my economics is a little dated, is what we're referring to is the government borrowing money that's probably idle and spending it to throw it into circulation to create employment, and therefore people who have jobs spend money, and the people they spend it to spend some of it, and really therefore stimulate the economy by taking idle funds and putting them in action. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, the main thing is to compensate for the fall off in private spending. Otherwise, the economy just goes into a downward spiral, as it's been doing. And so that's what, and they don't necessarily have to borrow all of it. In fact, the Fed has financed some of our budget deficit, about $1.2 trillion so far that the Fed has added to its balance sheet that was just money creation. You can do that also in a recession like this where there is no serious danger of inflation getting out of control.
It's funny you should mention there's no serious danger of inflation getting out of control, because it seems that the main position, and correct me if I'm wrong again, but as I followed the economic debates over the last few months and especially the last few weeks, the main position in the Republican Party, the opposition, has been that any further stimulus or deficit spending will be worse than the cure, because it will lead to, you know, destabilization of the economy through inflation and sort of crowding out of the private sector by the public sector. I don't know if there are other Republican theories out there I'm missing. This seems to be the dominant one. You don't. Doesn't sound to me like you take that argument very seriously.
No, and I don't think most economists do either. I mean, you know, inflation for the last year is actually negative 0.7%, and even going forward, you know, maybe we can expect about 2%. So all the spending we've had, including the money creation that I just mentioned, has not led to any appreciable pickup of inflation. Now, you know, if the Fed were to continue with the same policies, you know, when the recovery is well underway, then yeah, then maybe you could get some inflation. But that's, they're not going to do that, and that's really all there is to it. So there isn't really any basis for those arguments. You're correct; those are the two arguments. The other one is crowding out, that you're going to crowd out private investment, but that's also something that doesn't make any sense in a deep recession like this, where investment is. Has fallen so much and continues to be so weak. You really need you need private demand. The investors are not going to invest if they don't see people out there willing to buy. And you know, you've had maybe a little bit of boost. Consumption is probably stronger than it would have been as a result of the stimulus that we've had so far, but it's just way too small. Relative to the decline that, again, that we can expect from the collapse of an $8 trillion housing bubble. I guess if you're looking at it in terms of media, too, that's probably the biggest thing that the media has missed. You still don't see the word bubble very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people, you know, even progressives, they think this is primarily a financial crisis because that's how the media has been reporting it. But If you fixed all the banks tomorrow and there was nothing wrong with them, and all their bad assets, toxic assets, suddenly became good again, you wouldn't have a drastically different situation from what we have today, because the primary cause of this recession was the bursting of this enormous housing bubble and the effect that that has on private spending.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. He is the co-director with Dean Baker, who wrote the book Social Security, The Phony Crisis, published by University of Chicago Press. He is a journalist. You can find his work in NewsFind newspapers and on the web, writing regularly on economic and political matters. He's been a frequent guest here of Media Matters over the years. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Mark Weisbrot, the number 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We intend to talk about Honduras and Latin America during the course of the program. If you're interested in that issue, you can call in with questions there. I'm sure he'd be glad to field them. Right now, we're talking about the economy, a subject Mark Weisbrot has written and investigated and studied over the years and writes about in a popular voice that is unusual for economists and very welcome for those of us who aren't equipped really to deal with the heavy lifting of economics. And Mark Weisbrot, if were President Obama to telephone you and say, Mark, I listened to McChesney's show and you've convinced me, how big would you tell him the stimulus should be, were he to ask you? What sort of numbers do you think we really need to drive demand to a point to get the economy on a stable basis and a growing basis?
Well, that's a good question.
That's why I asked you.
I would say a stimulus of another over the next, so if we're talking about the rest of this year and next year, I would say another 3% of GDP.
And that translates into how many billions?
That would be about 400 billion.
That actually doesn't seem that scary after what we've been through in terms of a stimulus.
No, that's the other. I guess we left out the other argument that the right has been using, which is that the debt will explode and that will cause us to suffer for generations to come. And that really is without much economic foundation as well, because, we had a debt of 109% of GDP after World War II in 1946, and then we had... from that point on, for 30 years, the fastest growth in the history of the United States. And unlike the growth we've had in the last 35 years, it was widely shared. Everybody did a lot better from the bottom quintile all the way to the top. So the future of, the future of this economy is not at all going to be determined by how much debt we pile up during this recession. In fact, it's just the opposite. The future generations will do better to the extent that they inherit a more productive economy with a bigger capital stock, and that's what they'll get if we get out of this recession sooner rather than later.
Are we still technically in the recession, or are we formally in what they call the recovery period, moving up? Where are we in this process?
I would say we're definitely in the recession, but, that isn't officially determined until sometime after it's over.
Mm-hmm. You don't really know till later when you've gotten out of it?
Well, the National Bureau of Economic Research is the official arbiter of what the beginning and the end of the recession is. So they've called the beginning. That was in December of 2007. And they won't call the end until some months, at least, after it's over.
When I look, Mark Weisbrot, at these job numbers, which I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're looking at job numbers that are the worst or equal, if not worse, than anything since the 1930s in our economy at this point. I mean, I think we're even past the early 1980 recession, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of where the job situation is. It strikes me as awfully difficult to see how those jobs come back in this economy. And I don't say that with any great amount of expertise, but it seems that our economy has been so hollowed out in the last 30 or 40 years of manufacturing jobs. It's just hard to see how 15 million people get really good paying jobs at some point in this economy.
Well, I mean, the pay, that's going to have, you know, a lot of that has to do with the reduced bargaining power of labor. And that's another item on the political agenda, which is the Employee Free Choice Act, as you know, that, you know, labor and all of its allies are pushing for, which would make it much easier to organize unions in this country. And that's going to be a, you know, that's going to be another test for Obama. Is he going to really support that? Is he going to whip the conservative Democrats in the Senate, for example, who might not vote for it, or might not vote to end a filibuster, which Republicans would filibuster it. But that's, you know, that's partly bargaining power. It's partly, this is again another economic issue that's vastly misunderstood in the media and causes great confusion among the public. Partly because our dollar has been overvalued for such a long time. I'd say, you know, of the more than 4 million manufacturing jobs we've lost over the last decade, most of that is due to the dollar being overvalued. It's like giving a huge subsidy to anybody who wants to export to the United States and placing a huge tariff on everything that comes out of the United States. So both we get hit both on the export side, but also on the import side, because of having an overvalued currency. And the standard conventional wisdom you see in the papers is that we should be very worried that the dollar will fall and that this is somehow terrible. But in fact, it's one of the best things that could happen to this economy.
Where does the dollar stand right now relative to the euro and other currencies compared to like a year or two ago? And where is it heading in the next couple of years in your view?
Well, the dollar declined from 2002 to 2000 through 2007. It declined about 25% against a trade-weighted basket of currencies. Then during 2008 and some of this year, it came back, but not anywhere near what it fell, but a big chunk of it came back because investors from around the world came to the United States and to the dollar because they saw it, and to U.S. Treasuries because they saw it as a safe haven. And so that pushed the dollar back up. And now just, you know, very recently it's starting to come down a little bit now. So it still has to decline a lot more if we're going to have a sustainable economy. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why we have been, I would say a big reason why this economy has been dependent on this enormous bubble-driven consumption that we had first from the stock market bubble in the late 90s and then the housing bubble until that burst in 2006, is because we had this chronic trade deficit and growing trade deficit. And because of the imbalance of our currency. And that, so we had to make up for that somehow. And so we really didn't have sustainable growth. We had bubble growth. And it's always going to be unsustainable if it's based on an unsustainable trade deficit. Now, the trade deficit has come down quite a bit and since this recession. That's one of the things a recession does. Is it reduces your trade deficit, and so the the current account, which is the broader measure, includes trade and a few other things. You know that peaked at about 7% of our economy, and that around 2006, and that's now down to only 3.2%. But the problem is that as soon as the economy recovers, that comes back the same way that it went down. Unless there's a realignment of our currency. And I just emphasize this, because this is one of the fundamental imbalances in the global economy, and you hear a lot of talking about it, but again, the media is missing the main thing.
Well, Mark, let me interrupt you on that point, because who in the United States, what interests like having a strong dollar? I mean, what are the political forces that say this is where we should be?
Now that's another very good question. I think that's the question that the media doesn't ask. Well, Yeah, there's a very huge conflict of interest here. The big financial firms, the financial sector in general, they have an interest in a strong dollar because, first, it makes it cheaper for anything they want to buy overseas, even multinational corporations that want to buy labor or assets overseas. Everything's cheaper for them. And, of course, the bondholders and the financial sector generally, they like a strong dollar because it lowers inflation. And so, in other words, it makes imports cheaper. And all other things being equal, you know, you're going to have lower inflation if your imports are cheaper. Now, you and I, and most of the everybody you know, we'd rather have another half point of inflation and have another few million jobs in the economy. But that trade-off is exactly, that trade-off is looked at in a completely opposite manner by the financial sector. They don't have any, they don't care at all about the growth of the economy or the unemployment rate or the growth of wages. All they really care about is inflation. Because this sector is so powerful, and of course you can see that even in the appointments of the Obama administration.
You know, we have three callers who've been waiting patiently, and let me try to go to them if we can, Mark Weisfeld, sure. Right now before their phone bills go off the charts. Let's start, if we can, with line one, Champaign County. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Mark Weisfeld.
Oh, well, thank you. I know you'll continue with the economics argument for a while, I wonder, the one place where the bubble is being talked about is in, curiously enough, Rolling Stone, and Matt Taibbi might be a good guest rather than asking Mark to comment on that idea. But I wanted to turn, and I'm sure you were planning on it, to Honduras. Earlier, Mark, you had a piece in Post-Global when you were talking about Iran, and it was admirable that they put it in, but I see the Guardian Unlimited is where you've gotten your argument about Honduras. I don't know if it's getting much press. Yeah, I've been preoccupied with the other instance that probably caused the coup. Your prior experience with Aristide indicates that, and the economic aspect of this is that raising the minimum wage is something you don't do without consulting with your ambassador, whether it's Negroponte or whomever did it. Denied it in Haiti. But there's another instance that I think should be brought up, and that's the one of the other things that seems to have initiated the coup was Zelaya's attempt to make a military base at Palmero, a civilian base. This is a base that's still used by the American military, and it was instituted at the time of the Dirty War in Central America. So it seems to me that, frankly, body dumps are probably at stake, and figuring out what happened to the disappeared in Honduras still after all these years and what kind of complicity would have been involved. An old crime, but still one that should be looked at. And I think this part of the motivation for the coup and the U.S. military's implication in this is one that needs to be analyzed. And doing the Google search, the only American paper that had any mention of this that I could find through a variety of searches was San Francisco Gate, online journal of the San Francisco Chronicle. So I know that's a lot, I appreciate all your work. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Mark, before you answer that question, I don't want to get too far into the weeds in Honduras before there's a little more overview. So maybe, if you don't mind, for many of our listeners, I suspect, are not really totally on top of the situation in Honduras because it's sort of gotten shuffled to the side in the news media, especially with the Michael Jackson funeral and events. Maybe you could just give some general explanation of what happened in Honduras, why it's important. It's an overview before you get into the caller's question.
Sure. Well, it's extremely important, I think. I mean, no one pays much attention to Honduras. It's, you know, one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere. It's only 7 million people. And it's hardly reported on at all, but it's a huge thing because of what happened there. I mean, because it was a military coup that overthrew a democratically elected government, which is something that used to happen a lot in Latin America and doesn't, and is supposedly a thing of the past. And it's going to, and it is also a big test for the Obama administration. And just, okay, a little background. There was a constitutional crisis that came to a head in Honduras on June 28th because the president wanted to take a non-binding poll of the electorate, that is, nothing that would make law, but just a poll which he believed and had some legal basis for saying so, that he was had the right to do. And so he tried to do that, and the Congress tried to stop him. Now, the poll had one question. It said, do you want, it asked the people, do you want to put a, what they call a fourth ballot on the November 29th ballot election, asking whether people should, whether we should elect a constituent assembly to redraft the Constitution? And that was all it said. But the Congress and the Supreme Court and the military, basically the elite of Honduras, all were against him doing that. And so in order to stop him, well, he tried to go ahead with it, and the military, who he ordered to put the to distribute the voting materials and ballot boxes, they refused to carry out the orders. So he fired the head of the military, General Romeo Vasquez. The president fired him. He's commander-in-chief. And then the Supreme Court said that the firing was illegal. Majority of Congress went against the president. And instead of having, you know, trying to resolve this in some way, this conflict between the branches of government, they had a coup. They went to the, on the Sunday morning, they went to the house, a couple hundred troops, to the, at gunpoint. They took the president out of the country and flew him to Costa Rica. And so that's the background. Now, there's a lot more background that's missing. I don't know how much you want. Like,
well, probably not too much more because we have a lot of ground to cover. But if there's something especially pertinent, please
give it. Well, there is. You know, here, let me give you an example. I was talking to one of my neighbors here who is educated and follows the news. And there are only three things that he knew about this. And one was that this had something to do with Chavez in Venezuela, that he was behind this in some way, you know. Two was he believed that President Zelaya was trying to hold a referendum that would extend his term. Now, that is what the New York Times actually reported, and that's completely false. I just told you what was on that ballot, okay? And it was actually impossible for him to extend his term. Even if he had gone ahead with this referendum and won the referendum, then there would be another step where then he would have to get it on the November 29th ballot because this referendum wouldn't do that. And even if he had gone that far, and then the voters had voted to redraft the Constitution, he still had to leave office because on that same ballot in November, he would be replaced by another president, and he would not be allowed to run in that election. So there was absolutely no question of him extending his term of office, and yet thousands of articles that you probably have read as well, and everyone I know has read, have convinced them that this president was trying to extend his term in office. So that was terrible misreporting, and it helped, I think, the people who were trying to justify the coup. And, of course, the whole thing about Chavez, that's just a standard right-wing thing, right? Whenever something happens in Latin America, whether it's an election in Peru or Mexico or, you know, anywhere, El Salvador, they always run against Chavez, right? So that was just standard right-wing fare, but that was also repeated by the media. Now, why is it so important? It's important because you have all of Latin America taking a very strong stance against this coup, and you don't have our government doing the same thing. Again, this has not been reported very accurately. So here's all you really need to know about the Obama administration and the coup. All you have to do is look at the first statement that came out of the White House on that Sunday when the coup happened. Now, they were completely prepared for this because all of their, according to their own admission, they were talking to the military of Honduras right up to the day of the coup. So they knew what was going to happen. I mean, I knew what was going to happen. You know, I knew there was a very high probability of this. So they were prepared. And Obama's, President Obama's statement was unique in the world because he did not condemn the coup or even criticize it. He said all political and social actors in Honduras should respect democratic norms, the rule of law, and the tenets of the Inter-American Democratic Charter. That was his statement. Everyone else in South America, the European Union, condemned the coup and called for the president of Honduras, the legitimate president, to be reinstated. Now, the Obama administration eventually came around to, after 8 days, to statements like that, although very remarkably, Hillary Clinton did not. Our Secretary of State would refuse, even as recently as Tuesday, last Tuesday, refused when asked, she would not say that they wanted to return the elected president. So that, to me, is so obvious. I mean, everybody who knows diplomatic language or follows these kinds of events, every diplomat I know in Washington knows where the United States really stands on this. They would like to see the coup government stall out the rest of Zelaya's term. He's only got 6 months left. And that would be a victory for them and a terrible blow to democracy in the United States. But the press, again, is reporting it as though President Obama and the Obama administration is unequivocally on the side of restoring the democratically elected president.
Well, that was a very good summary, Mark Weisbrot. Don, do you have any specific comments you'd like to make about what the caller was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he mentioned why, you know, some reasons why the elite of Honduras turned against Zelaya, and one of it was he raised the minimum wage 60%, you know. And this is a very poor country. I mean, you know, over 60% of the country's in, actually the 70% of the country's below the poverty line. Majority's in extreme poverty. And so this was something that was necessary, but you know, he had to confront the entire elite of the country. The Catholic Church went against him because he vetoed a bill that was intended to outlaw the emergency contraception. You know, so the whole elite went against him, and of course the United States was against him for a whole set of reasons having to do with just he was another left government that was, you know, there's been 11 left presidents elected in Latin America since they tried to overthrow Chavez in 2002, and so naturally our government is against Zelaya as well for all of these reasons.
Our guest today, Mark Weisbrot. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have several callers who have been waiting patiently. I want to thank you. I'm going to go directly to the phone lines right now. Our number here, if you want to join them, is 333-9455. The toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. With no further ado, let's now go to line two. Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Mark, are you okay with going back to talking about the economy, or would you like to stay with Honduras?
Oh, it's up to you. You can ask a question on whatever you want.
Okay. Via the economy. Right now, it's my understanding that the money for, for instance, Illinois just passed, our governor just signed the infrastructure bill to allow the for the stimulus money to start being spent in our state. And I'm just wondering that if that money is just now starting to come in for infrastructure, then with the things like picking up in construction and for the larger construction companies, all the way, you know, labor all the way up to management. And then it seems to me it's tied to the energy bill, because when that's passed, that's going to also stimulate the economy via the energy sector, which is going to help jobs. And it seems to me the two of them together, especially the energy bill, is going to help the trade deficit, putting us back into a place of manufacture. And I'll just ask whether or not you agree with that, or if you see some holes in that, or and why.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Mark Weisbrot?
I'm not sure I understand the part about the trade deficit, but in terms of the stimulus, if you look at, you know, what is left left in the current stimulus bill for next year, it's just about $80 billion in terms of actual spending projects. So that's, you know, it's about 0.5% of GDP, and that's just way too small. That's just not even a fifth of the fall off in housing construction that we've had since the housing bubble burst, and it's, maybe a tenth as large as the drop in consumption that you get from, again, that I described from the housing bubble bursting. So you're just talking about numbers that are way too small, even if they do go into effect pretty soon.
You know, Mark, before we get to our next caller, I want to do a follow-up on the economy. Over the last year, I've had many guests, and you might have been one of them, because I know you came out in October right after the fiscal crisis or financial crisis exploded. And the recommendation of progressive and liberal economists was, if not uniformly, significantly biased toward nationalizing all the banks, taking them over, and then reprivatizing them once the thing had been cleared up. Do you think it's safe to say now that the Obama approach has been a success and that nationalization really wasn't necessary?
No, because it's just not over yet. I mean, even the stress tests were not based on the economic scenario that's likely to unfold from, you know, just looking forward. So I don't think that we're just nowhere near out of the woods yet. I mean, if the economy, you know, at that time, they were projecting that the economy would, the second half of this year, which is now, the recovery would start, and then it would, you know, intensify in next year. That did not happen, and I don't think that these banks are out of the woods yet at all.
Our guest, Mark Weisbrot. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 3, Rantoul, thank you very much for your patience. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Hello. There are a lot of people on fixed incomes and paychecks that are actually shrinking in terms of numbers and decreasing jobs, as we all know. What is the impact of a decreasing value of the United States dollar on people like us? Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, thank you very much, caller. Mark Weisbrot?
Well, if you're it depends on what you look at. If you look at the the short term, the immediate term, the long run, but obviously, if the dollar falls within a year or so, you will get some increased inflation, but it's not huge. You know, I mean, you can see it from the past, right? It fell from 2002 to 2007, fell by 25%, and you didn't get any increase in inflation or any real noticeable increase in inflation from that. Now, obviously, there's a lot of other things going on. But what it does do, the most important thing it does from the point of view of people who are working for a living, is it saves a lot of manufacturing and import competing jobs. And if it stays down long enough, you would even see some factories come back here. Some manufacturing that we have lost would actually come back because it would be competitive again, because the dollar is determining, you know, how competitive our manufacturing exports are, or how our manufacturing for the domestic market can be against imports. So from the point of view of the vast majority of people who work for a living, and because, you know, not just manufacturing and import competing industries, but, you know, wages in the overall economy are also affected, and employment, by what happens in manufacturing and in import competing industries. So the bottom line is that most people would be much better off with a much lower competitive dollar. And this is true. Every country in the world, you know, almost most countries in the world, they realize that, you know, look at Argentina, Indonesia, countries all over the world. Germany, you know, there's always a huge section that knows that they get hurt from having a dollar. But our having an overvalued currency, but our financial sector is so strong here that it's managed to convince people
that a strong dollar is somehow good for them.
Mark Weisfeld, let me interject sort of another way of addressing the strong dollar issue, an issue we haven't really talked about yet, but I know you've written about it, which is that the dollar has been in effect, the global currency for several decades now, since the 1970s, and probably in effect the global currency since the 40s, de facto. And, you know, part of the deal, as I understood it, of the strong dollar was that because it was strong, other countries were willing to, you know, swallow up all the debts here, and we could have a higher standard of living because there were these massive debts that China and other countries would hold in dollar that they wouldn't hold if dollar was weak. And if the dollar looks like it's getting weaker, they're going to dump it. And how much is that sort of the U.S. dominance of the global economy tied to the strong dollar? And, you know, are there benefits we've gotten as a result of that from making countries take our debt way beyond what they would for any other country, for example, in the near term? I mean, is that a factor at all in this, or is it just simply a question of lower dollar, good for workers, and that international stuff doesn't matter that much otherwise?
Well, you know, the question is, the key word in your question is the we, you know. There's no doubt that some people are better off for having the strong dollar, and I mentioned all the interests that are. But does the average person benefit? I don't think so. I think, you know, we would have been better off having balanced growth rather than taking on this foreign debt and having this, you know, that actually is a burden to have a big foreign debt. You know, they always emphasize the government debt in the media, but really the government debt is not really the problem. It's the, and we do have foreign borrowing in the government debt, but that's because our dollar is overvalued. So, no, I don't think we benefit from having the dollar as a key currency. Not most people. I mean, look at all the manufacturing jobs we've lost. I mean, that's part of the thing. You know, the part of having the world's key currency is that your leaders feel an obligation to maintain its value even when it's overvalued. And we all suffer for that. So, yeah, I mean, it is true that the United States can run big trade deficits that other countries could not necessarily get away with. But I don't really see that as a great advantage. It's in a way, it's like asking, you know, was it really good for people to borrow so much against their homes during the housing bubble? Did they really benefit from having their home, rise to an inflated price and borrow against it and then end up in the situation they are today?
So, Mark, just to cut to the chase then, the sort of concern you see in the business press, and I guess to some extent in the economics literature, but I'd say more in the business press, that it would be of great damage to the United States to no longer be the global currency, that sort of the U.S. reign over world capitalism would be lessened. That doesn't bother you. To you, that's not a great concern for the American people. That's more a concern for Wall Street.
Yeah, Wall Street, and also for people who are looking, you know, a lot of what our policymakers do is they're looking at it from the point of view of empire, you know, what makes them powerful in the world. That's why they care so much about the IMF being able to tell all these countries what to do. We don't benefit from that, but they benefit from, you know, from the point of view of having power in the world. And so having the world's key currency, controlling the world's most important multilateral organizations, those are things that give them power, but they don't necessarily, that stuff doesn't trickle down to the rest of us here in this country. And it's pretty easy to see that if you just look at what happened. I mean, look at what happened during this last 35 years while the United States, you know, became this, since 1990, right, the unchallenged superpower. What did that get us here in the world? You know, we have the worst inequality we've ever had, and wages that have been practically stagnant, real wages, for the last 35 years. So we don't necessarily benefit from this at all.
Mark, our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Mark Weisfeld, who's graciously joined us. We have time for more callers. The line here, 333-9455. Toll-free still open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to one of our most patient callers ever. Line 1, Champaign-Urbana, you're on the air with Mark Weisfeld.
Mark, Jim Iman. would you be so kind as to return to the Employee Free Choice Act? There is a question here of to what extent this really repeals the Taft-Hartley Act, which is the crux piece of legislation, the crux law that's keeping labor down. In my opinion, from my investigations, it's at best one quart in a five-gallon bucket. We're on a short time. I'll ring off and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. And Mark, if you don't mind, if you could briefly explain what the Taft-Hartley Act was and why it's so important so people understand what the caller was about.
Well, it had a number of provisions, but I'm not sure that this is the main thing that the Employee Free Choice Act has to do with. I think it gave, for example, the government more strength to intervene in affairs of unions. But the main thing the Employee Free Choice Act would do is to allow workers to organize unions by getting a majority of workers to sign a card saying they want to join. And if those cards are verified, then they'd be able to have the union. Now, under current law, that's only the first step to getting a union. And then they have to go through a whole process, which involves an election. And between the time you get the card signed and the time you actually get the election, the employers tend to intervene by firing people, intimidating them, and everything else that they do. So as a result, you have a huge decline in the rate of unionization for decades now. It's down to 8% of the labor force in the private sector. So what this would do mainly is to be able to, it would level the playing field a little bit or significantly so that the will of the majority of workers could be expressed and made into law.
The campaign against the Employee Free Choice Act, which is already in high gear by the opponents to the act, suggests that this is a bill that will make it very easy for union bosses to ram unions down the throat of workers. This is an extraordinarily undemocratic process that will take place. And it also argues that it's a job killer because if it's successful, it's going to force businesses to pay labor more, and in this recession, it'll drive them out of business and increase unemployment. How do you respond to those two claims?
Well, I mean, you could have said the same thing about the National Labor Relations Act during the New Deal. You know, that was during a depression, and it gave workers more bargaining power. And I haven't seen anybody make an economic argument that prolonged the depression or anything. So I don't see any merit to those arguments. In terms of, democracy, it's clearly, the employer, for example, can always agree to this card check procedure if they want to right now under current law. So all this does is say that workers should also be able to make the same choice that employers make. If the majority of workers sign a card, and they says they want to be a union. Well, right now, if the employer agrees, then it's done. But if the employer doesn't agree, well, this will change the law, so it's still done. So all you're really saying is that the workers should have the same kind of voice that the employer has, and it's hard to see why that is undemocratic.
Let's go back to the phone lines for at least one more call. Let's go to our toll-free line, line 4. Chicago, you're on there with Mark Weisbrot.
What's your choice when there's a hole in the bucket? Automation, computerization, robots replacing humans, and what kind of jobs are there for humans except for in the service sector and other areas? So the Pope recently at the G8 conference employed the people to restructure the financial conditions as a result of the tsunami from the economic wheelers and dealers that brought it on. So between they're reaping the profits and ignoring the human aspect and replacement of humans by all the robots and etc., and of course the loss of jobs. Well, to summarize it, Those calling shots have to have the ammunition unloaded a little bit. They've been too strong in the picking and choosing what they can do, and others are ignored as human beings. Bye.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Mark, do you have any comments on that?
No, I just think that, you know, the problem of automation isn't necessarily a problem. If you have the right macroeconomic policies, you can still maintain full employment.
Let's go to another caller, line one, Urbana. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Hi. I just have a question about Honduras. I heard that Oscar Arias was mediating the situation of the coup in Honduras, and I was wondering if this is the kind of political scenario set up by the OEA and the U.S. government on the elected Democratic president that was ousted, on what happened to this negotiation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, Mark, if you could give some background on
sure.
Oscar Arias.
Sure. A few days ago, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arranged for the president of Costa Rica, Oscar Arias, to mediate between the coup president, the de facto president, who was installed by the military in the Congress in Honduras, and President Zelaya, the elected president that the whole world has recognized as the legitimate president. And, you know, I think this nothing came of this mediation so far as would be expected, because the coup government in Honduras, you know, refuses to say that he can come back. And of course, Zelaya isn't going to accept anything less than that. I think this was a bad thing. What it did was, I think, again, it shows that the State Department here is trying to make it look like there's, you know, both sides are kind of equal in some sense, where as the UN General Assembly, the Organization of the American States, I mean, everybody that has taken a vote has taken a unanimous vote that said the president, the elected president, should be unconditionally and immediately restored. And so what Clinton did by arranging this mediation was to try and help the coup government stall for time, but I don't think it's going to work. I think Zelaya is going to go back there one way or another.
Mark Weisbrot, we've only got about a minute left, and we've had you on the air several times, and I don't think we ever had a chance to ask you to talk a little bit more about the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who it is, what you guys do, and how people can learn more about it. So why don't you take a minute and tell us that?
Sure. Well, the website is cepr.net, the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And I guess you get some idea of what we do from what we've talked about today. We look at primarily economic issues, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly the economic issues that we think are most important for people to be able to understand so that they can have some input, some democratic input into policy decisions. And about half of our work, or a little more than half, is on the domestic economy, and the rest focuses on international issues.
On that note, Mark Weisbrot, I hear the band tuning up the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. It's my pleasure.
And I want to thank Kyle Krawhoff for working the board, Lori Serb for sitting in today as the producer. I'm Bob McChesney. Have a great week, everyone. See you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
in the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana. Mostly sunny skies today with a high around 80 degrees. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with a low around 60. Monday, mostly sunny with a high of 82. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low of 65. Tuesday, partly sunny with a high of 85. And rain moves in Tuesday night with a low around 70. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.